WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, sitting in for Terry Gross. It's been 2 years since the Dayton Peace Accord brought an uneasy truce to the former Yugoslavia. UN peacekeepers have been patrolling the region, there have been a number of elections, and there's a semblance of normalcy for the war-weary public. But the absence of fighting, says New York Times reporter Chris Hedges, can be deceiving. The area is now divided into republics: Bosnia, Croatia, Macedonia, Slovenia, and the rump Yugoslavia Republic of Serbia and Montenegro. The nationalism and ethnic hatred which tore the region apart, Hedges says, is simmering just below the surface and is threatening the fragile peace process. We called Chris Hedges earlier today in Zagreb and asked him to fill us in on recent events in the region. He covered the war in the former Yugoslavia and is now the Balkan bureau chief for the New York Times. Recently, Chris Hedges had a story about the rise of street gang violence against gypsies living in Serbia. I asked him about these attacks.
What we've seen with this terrible economic deprivation in the last few months is a rise of neo-Nazi skinhead groups that go around in the streets of Belgrade at night and attack gypsies. They first began by attacking the street cleaners who work at night, most of whom are gypsy. They would strip them of their clothes, make them walk home naked. They would hold them down, light their hair on fire. They would beat them, this kind of stuff. And this has evolved into much more serious acts of violence. We had, before I wrote this story, 10 days before this story came out, a pregnant mother with three children was beaten to death by one of these groups, although she died in hospital. And then we had this boy that I wrote about when I was there, who had gone just down to the corner store to buy some juice and was picked up by these skinheads on the way back. They ripped a side of a drain pipe off the wall and beat him to death. I think the desperation fueled with this nationalist triumphalism, which has become part of the political discourse, is making it very difficult for people in the rump Yugoslavia who are not Serb.
Are these street thugs? Are they organized in some way? You talk about the Serbian nationalist propaganda or agenda. Are they just carrying out the will, perhaps the unspoken will of the government, or are they more reacting to the chaos that's in their republic?
I think they're reacting more to the chaos. I don't think the government wants these kinds of beatings to go on in the center of Belgrade. And I must say that after this young boy who was 14 was killed, the police presence in that area was pretty heavy. And they were grabbing skinheads and hauling them away. And they don't have the light touch in Belgrade either. I think these kids probably were in for a rough time. However, because it's become acceptable, socially acceptable, to speak like this, I do think the government bears a certain responsibility for these kinds of activities. But they're essentially ad hoc groups of kids who have nothing to do, and you know, this is really their form of rebellion and probably in a sick way their form of entertainment.
Do you see then these attacks on the gypsies as portending bigger problems, further ethnic and racial divisions, further ethnic and racial attacks?
Well, my feeling about the former Yugoslavia is that it has become politically acceptable and socially acceptable to use a language that we in the United States have fought very hard to abolish, and it is the language essentially of hate. It is a racist language. When Croats, for instance, speak about Serbs and Muslims, I view it as racist. The kinds of things they say are not only derogatory, but often smack of the kind of primitive racism, you know, in terms of sort of genetic inferiority, et cetera, that one hears from, you know, these sort of crazy militia-type groups in the United States, et cetera. And that's become, you know, it's affected everywhere. So I don't know how they're going to rise above that, because all of the nationalist leaders, President Tudjman, President Milosevic, and even President Izetbegovic, really base their political movements on this ethnic triumphalism, the flip side of which is, of course, racist. So until we get a new crop of leaders that don't embrace this terrible nationalist ideology, I don't know how they're going to people are going to dig their way out of it. I think the situation is probably worse in the rump Yugoslavia because the economy is dysfunctional. They're printing money without anything to back it up. They have severe problems with the 2 million ethnic Albanians in Kosovo who are launching an increasingly violent movement. They overran 11 police stations in September. Montenegro, which is the partner of Serbia, with Serbia in the rump Yugoslavia, is now moving to secede. So it's I think President Milosevic and his government are in deep, deep trouble all the way around. And this kind of chaos and economic misery tends to breed this kind of fanaticism.
I read that the unemployment rate is something like 50%.
Yes, probably more than that. I mean, you know, it's even people, one of the things you have to remember is that even people who have jobs don't really have salaries. I mean, it's not a salary that you can live on. It's not a real salary. So they're always trying to do something on the sly, sell gasoline or cigarettes or something, or drive cabs. Or it's a mess.
Well, there was a recent election in the Yugoslav Republic, and it looks as if the president of Montenegro is making noises about seceding from Serbia. Do you think is that just making noises, or do you think we actually might see something like that happen?
I think there is a legitimate movement by the new authorities in Montenegro, or certainly a consideration to secede. They're not going to do it now. They want to calm tempers in Belgrade. But they've sort of had it. Montenegro has 600,000 people. It's much smaller, of course, than Serbia. But they've paid the price of the war in terms of sanctions and everything else. And their feeling is that this was Milosevic's decision, not theirs. There's certainly strong support within Montenegro for that.
How then would you compare the election in the Yugoslav Republic with the election in Bosnia in September?
The election in Bosnia in September was a bit of a fiction because you were electing town councils based on the pre-war census. So, for instance, in Srebrenica, where the horrible massacre in the summer of 1995 took place of several thousand, probably about 7,000 Muslim men by the Bosnian Serbs, and then, of course, all of the remainder of the families were pushed out. There are no Muslims in Srebrenica now. But they could vote. I mean, the former residents could vote in these elections for the authorities, even though they weren't physically there. Or they were, if they were bussed into a polling station maybe on the day and then bussed out. So you have Muslim authorities who are elected, but they can't go there. Mm-hmm. You've created these sort of mini governments in exile. Who can't physically go to the places that they're supposed to govern, whose constituents don't live in those places, and really don't have anything to do. So, you know, unless the international community decides that these results will be implemented, that people will go back, that these governments will go back, these elections don't really end up meaning that much.
And yet some have said, looking at the turnout, some 75% turnout rate, there was no violence, no one died voting in Bosnia. Many see that as a victory, as certainly a first step towards some form of democracy.
Well, my feeling, you know, especially after spending now 2.5 years in Bosnia, is that democracy is a process. It's not an event. And we have lots of events in Bosnia, but I find most of them to be sterile. It is true that there was no violence, but the, you know, there's, 31,000 heavily armed NATO troops here. You go to polling stations and there's armored personnel carriers and, you know, British soldiers in flak jackets and everything else. It's be pretty foolish probably suicidal for any Bosnian Serb to go running in there with a pistol. So, I think it is true that there isn't violence, but I have yet to see these elections, and we've had a series of elections in Bosnia over the last couple years, that have fundamentally changed the nature of the partition of Bosnia. I mean, supposedly we have a federal government in place that is supposed to, with a tripartite presidency, with a Serb, a Croat, a Muslim, that under Dayton is supposed to run Bosnia, and they don't. The federal parliament doesn't meet, the federal bodies don't work. These people were elected to positions that don't function.
Why then do you think, and it's been about 2 years since the Dayton Peace Accords, why have those accords not been implemented? Is there something wrong with them? Is there some wrong-headed way that they were conceived of and carried out? Or is there something about the former Yugoslavia where it's just not going to work? And we're talking about unifying three ethnic groups into a unified state, some kind of democratic rule, some kind of multi-ethnic society. Is that impossible, do you think, at this point in that region?
Well, Dayton, you know, the architects of Dayton, led by Richard Holbrooke, they promised everything to everybody. And the Bosnian Serbs, for instance, have their own entity, their self-styled Republic of Srpska, the Croats have their enclave, the Muslims have theirs, and the Muslims, of course, want to create a unified structure. They are the majority in Bosnia. They want a federal system. The Serbs and the Croats do not. The Serbs and the Croats have powerful patrons, Belgrade and Zagreb. And they don't really need Sarajevo. So unless there is a change in the attitude of the international community, by which they will become incredibly proactive, i.e., taking the 1 million Muslims who were driven from their homes and physically putting them back into their communities, and probably having to help them rebuild their communities, most of which are destroyed, I don't really see how we're going to overcome this partition plan.
Well, I'll tell you what, I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a short break. And our guest today on Fresh Air is Chris Hedges. He's the Balkan Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and we'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Chris Hedges, and we're talking about the former Yugoslavia. You have a piece in today's New York Times looking at the Muslim killings of Serbs that were previously unknown. How did you find out about this story?
Well, that story came from internal military court documents that were leaked to me, and these were the confessions and testimonies of 16 paramilitary soldiers who had been a member of one of these paramilitary units at the beginning of the war and who admitted to having seen or been involved in the abduction and murder of ethnic Serbs who were living in Sarajevo.
And had you heard rumors of this while the war was going on?
Yes, you did hear rumors, but you didn't hear anything more than that. The people were afraid to speak, especially Serbs who were in Sarajevo were afraid to speak. And although the hardline Bosnian Serb government in Pale harped on this as an issue, they would throw out these fantastic stories. I mean, for instance, I remember them telling us that there was a hotel in Sarajevo where they held Serb girls were being raped by Muslim soldiers, and there were 10,000 missing, and it was so fantastical. And they never did any kind of real, work in terms of gathering credible testimony. Part of it's difficult because people flee and you don't know where they are, and there's no coordination and communications are bad. I think, took this document, a couple then of building on that document, of course, interviewing the former commander of the Bosnian Army and the deputy commander and the former police chief and others who were willing to confirm that this kind of activity was happening.
And it may not have been on the scale of Serbian atrocities, but was it the same malevolence?
It certainly was. It was, of course, like all journalists, I print longer stories than my newspaper ever wants to publish, but they cut out some parts at the end that were really just gruesome. I mean, there was, there was a beheading and mutilation, and at one point they had caught these two young Serb men who were trying to sneak across the front lines. The city was surrounded to the Serb side, and they were plunging knives into their corpses, and it was just disgusting. So this was the kind of stuff that happened on the Serb side all the time. It didn't happen, with the same frequency on the Muslim side, but it did happen on the Muslim side.
But you also detail or talk about the secret trials that were held. How were these soldiers punished, if at all?
Most of the sentences were pretty light. Of the 16... First of all, they were only tried for the murder of 10 people, most of whom were ethnic Serbs. I think it's pretty clear that They probably, this unit alone, and there were other paramilitary units that were also involved in these kinds of atrocities. This unit alone probably killed dozens of people in the particular rocky crevice that they used to drop bodies in. It's about 80 foot deep. It's on the side of a mountain outside of Sarajevo, or on the edge of Sarajevo. They began an investigation. They exhumed 29 bodies, and then the Sarajevo government, for whatever reason, halted the investigation. But I spoke to the head of the Sarajevo police, who was in charge of the investigation at the time, and he said clearly there was indication that there were more bodies down there. So it was probably it was certainly more widespread than the government let on. They tried them for these 10 killings. 14 of them were convicted, and most of them were given a sentence of just a few months. Four of them were given six-year prison terms, and they're still in jail.
Any evidence that officials in the government or higher-ups either knew about it or ordered it or looked the other way?
I think there's pretty clear evidence that they knew about it and they looked the other way. But you have to remember that in the early days of the war, the Muslims had no army. They had really no organized defense. And they relied on these criminal gangs to literally hold front lines around the city. They claim, and I think with some justification, that the chaos of the time and the desperation made it difficult to investigate rumors of what was happening on a section of front line controlled by one of these paramilitary units. However, it does appear to me from working on this story for the last week that they had pretty clear indications several months before they moved, including a five-page letter that I saw that it was written to President Ali Izetbegović by the deputy commander of the Bosnian army, listing names and talking about these kinds of killings.
There are some, 34,000 members of the NATO-led peacekeeping force now stationed in the former Yugoslavia. How are they doing in terms of their mission there, and how are they received by the people of the region? How do they view them?
Their mission, essentially, certainly as the NATO commanders define it, is to maintain the ceasefire and prevent violence. And that aspect of their mission has been accomplished with really very few problems. All heavy weapons are in cantonments so that even if a firefight broke out, there'd be no access to mortars or tanks or anything like that. They've achieved a status where it's not really peace, but it's the absence of war. We've never gone beyond that. Now, mm-hmm. NATO officials say that's not our role to go beyond that. That is the role of the civilian administrators who came in and were tasked with making Dayton work. The civilian administrators counter this by saying, well, we can't make Dayton work if we don't have the force or the coercive power to get the parties to comply, and NATO doesn't want to do that. So there's been this sort of stalemate ever since the troops deployed, which was December of 95. We really haven't gotten beyond this.
What do you think would happen if the UN forces left the region? Would it erupt into war?
I think it would, and I think it would because the Bosnian Serbs were really broken by the NATO bombing in the fall of 1995. They had 2 weeks of sustained bombing. This was an effort to get them to pull their guns back from around Sarajevo, where they were lobbing about 1,000 shells a day in the city. But it wasn't just an attack on the guns around the city. They went after barracks, even down to individual pieces of armor, warehouses, communication systems, and they've never really recovered from that. They have no money. Radovan Karadzic distrusts the army. There was an effort by army commanders, Bosnian Serb army commanders, to actually remove him in 1993, and he built up his own Praetorian Guard within the police. So the Muslims, especially with this training that they've been getting, this American effort to train them and give them new equipment, are getting more experienced. They're getting better hardware. Their morale is high. I think there is a feeling that it probably wouldn't take too much for a resurgent Muslim force, especially given the state of the Bosnian Serbs, for them to move and take the rest of Bosnia, when the Serbs have 49%. And the Muslims, while they publicly don't say that this is their goal, often say, you know, Dayton promised us one united country, and the Serbs have been obstructing the agreement at Dayton, which they signed off on, ever since it was implemented. And if the agreement itself is unable to achieve this goal, then we'll achieve it by other means. That's sort of on the record as far as they'll go. But privately, I think there's no question that if NATO pulled out, the chances of fighting, probably for that reason, are great.
Well, about one-third of the NATO peacekeeping force is American, are American soldiers. And Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State, said last week that she felt that the troops needed to stay past June. And the question, I guess, is whether Congress can be convinced of that. If the Americans pulled out of this peacekeeping force, what effect do you think it would have on the force itself?
Well, the British and the French, and it is the British, the French, and the Americans who constitute the backbone of the force. The British and the French say they will leave. They're unequivocal about that, and I think that is a problem. I don't cover London or Paris, so I don't know how much of it is posturing, but I suspect that I think they would leave, and I think there is a strong feeling that certainly among American NATO commanders that it is important for America to remain, for NATO's credibility, and also you certainly don't want this war to spread and resume again. I think part of that reason is that without an American presence here, probably the mission would fall apart.
Chris Hedges is the Balkan bureau chief for the New York Times. He's been covering the region since the war began, and he'll be back with us in the second half of the show. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen in for Terry Gross. Let's continue our conversation with Chris Hedges, Balkan bureau chief for the New York Times. He covered the war in the former Yugoslavia for the Times, and he's been writing about events and conditions there since the fighting stopped. I want to talk a little bit about the war crimes tribunals, and certainly they've been sold, if I can say that, as a way of providing closure, bringing some order, some justice. Any evidence that that's occurred because of the war crimes tribunals?
Has it brought closure? Well, we haven't had very many convictions yet. Most of the Bosnian Serbs, of course, have not been apprehended, and they constitute the bulk of those who are indicted. The people who directed the war on the Bosnian Serb side, General Ratko Mladic and Radovan Karadzic, of course, remain at large. I don't think that The Hague, I think the concept is a good one, but I don't think it's had that kind of an impact yet, partly because they just don't have the people yet.
And by that you mean they don't have the police force to go get them, or they just literally don't have the people who are accused of the crimes?
Well, the tribunal has no police force. The tribunal is really dependent on essentially NATO or international troops in Bosnia to make arrests for them. There is, of course, this constant call for the ethnic leaderships to turn over their own war criminals. And we did have, by the way, under heavy pressure, President Tuđman intervene in the Croat enclave in Bosnia to turn over 10 indicted war criminals, including some very big leaders. I mean, it was a very significant move for Croatia. But we don't have that yet with the Serbs, and the Serbs really carried out the bulk of the war crimes. You know, there were war crimes committed by all sides, but when you stack up numerically, I think the Serbs probably, I mean, it's a wild guess, but probably 80% were committed by the Serbs.
Chris Hedges is our guest. He's the Balkan bureau chief for the New York Times. Well, I'm curious the difference, I guess, between covering this region during its uneasy peace and covering it under war conditions. Certainly under war conditions, you're seeing death and violence and a great deal of suffering. But what you're describing to us now is corruption and unemployment and the rise of racial hatred. Does that wear on you the way covering a war wears on you?
It wears differently. You know, this isn't the first war I've been in, but I'd never been in a city under siege. I'd never been, and it was a small area under siege. It was twice the size of Central Park. And that wore my nerves down. I mean, in other wars, the Gulf War, El Salvador, other places I've been, you would go to a frontline area and for a certain amount of time, maybe even a few days, and then you would come back to an area that was relatively safe. You never had that in Sarajevo. You were in this fishbowl, and you were never safe at all. I mean, there was big stuff coming in, you know, tank rounds, Katyusha rockets coming in all day long. And it had I never felt like I did, for instance, when I was in a firefight in southern Iraq or in El Salvador, where I really didn't know if I was going to get out. I never felt that kind of immediate danger, but it was this daily kind of uncertainty that really wore me down. Physically, I think wore everyone down. You get older, you're a little less resilient, but I think it got to everybody in the end. So I think that's the main problem of being in Sarajevo, was the main problem being in Sarajevo during the siege. It is a different kind of exhaustion, and I think it's reporters can get to a point where you feel like you've already written that story. You know, you tend to write on themes that you feel you've already covered, which is a good sign that it's probably time for another reporter to come in. And also, although it's not as dramatic, it has this corrosive quality where it just, you know, this kind of malaise, this kind of corruption, this kind of grayness, this kind of depression can make you feel sometimes paralyzed and certainly tired and exhausted and depressed.
Well, you've painted a fairly grim picture for us. Are there bright signs? And I don't want to be Pollyannish about
it. Well, are there bright sides? Well, there's always individual bright sides. I don't think it can be underestimated that this was a horrible, horrible war. 200,000 people died, most of them young. And I don't think you can underestimate the benefit of stopping the war. I mean, that is a real achievement. It may now sort of be like Gaza, but it's better to be like Gaza than to be like Beirut. There are families that, however much they're struggling, are not losing their sons or their daughters or their fathers or whoever. This took physically such a horrible toll on Bosnians that I do feel that you can never discount that achievement. I don't know. I don't see, for this generation, I think it's going to be difficult. I think, these kinds of problems take years to dig your way out of, despite all the goodwill of the international community. So I don't think there is any kind of quick and easy solution. Hopefully, over time, things will improve steadily and life will get better. But I think it's going to take years.
Well, I thank you very much, Chris Hedges, for joining us today on Fresh Air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chris Hedges is the Balkan Bureau Chief for The New York Times.